This is session two of Naropa Boulder, Allen Ginsberg Spontaneous Poetics, presently being taught by Phil Whalen. This is July 21st, 1976.
I'd like to make an announcement, please. James Sherry was...
I'll stand up again probably in a minute or two. Let's see if you can pick up what's going right now. Hello, hello. Hello, hello, hello. Is that all right? Okay. Thing is that I don't, I can't see, so I'm going to have to stand up.
You want a high stool?
No, that's okay. I can't see what's happening in the back row if I don't stand up. I remember, I'd sort of have to go by what sticks in my mind, what I remember from time to time. And what I remembered the other day was that somebody says, why do I have to read all these books in order to understand anything or write anything? And so in a book by the late Ben Jonson, who was a contemporary of Shakespeare, the book is called Explorata, or Discoveries, Timber. Timber is the popular name. This edition of Jonson, incidentally, is a very handy one. This is a Penguin edition of for several reasons. One reason is that it has modernized spelling, and there's an American edition by W.W. Norton that reproduces the old spelling, and which is much more visual. You can pick up on what it was he was seeing when he was writing a little better, or what people were looking at when they were reading him, if you look at the old spelling edition. There's yet a third edition from Oxford Press, which contains one more item, namely the leges conviviales, the laws for the people who like to have fun together that Jonson wrote in Latin. It's a long poem about how poets should get along together when they're sitting up there in the tavern where they used to sit and drink. But this particular edition is interesting because it has all the poems and it has the timber and the translation from Horace and whatnot. But in any case, apropos of what you have to know, for a man to write well, he says, there are required three necessities: to read the best authors, observe the best speakers, and much exercise of his own style. In style, to consider what ought to be written and after what manner. He must first think and excogitate his matter, then choose his words and examine the weight of either. Then take care in placing and ranking both matter and words that the composition be comely, and to do this with diligence and often. No matter how slow the style be at first, so it be labored and accurate, seek the best and be not glad of the forward conceits or first words that offer themselves to us, but judge of what we invent and order what we approve. Repeat often what we have formerly written, which beside that it helps the consequence and makes the juncture better, it quickens the heat of imagination that often cools in the time of setting down and gives it new strength as if it grew lustier by the going back. As we see in the contention of leaping, they jump farthest that fetch their race largest, or as in throwing a dart or javelin, we force back our arms to make our loose the stronger. Yet, if we have a fair gale of wind, I forbid not the steering out of our sail, so the favor of the gale deceive us not. For all that we invent doth please us in the conception or birth, else we would never set it down. But the safest is to return to our judgment and handle over again those things, the easiness of which might make them justly suspected. So did the best writers in their beginnings. They imposed upon themselves care and industry. They did nothing rashly. They obtained first to write well, and then custom made it easy and a habit. By little and little, their matter showed itself to them more plentifully. Their words answered Their composition followed, and all, as in a well-ordered family, presented itself in the place. So that the sum of all is, ready writing makes not good writing, but good writing brings on ready writing. Yet when we think we have got the faculty, it is even then good to resist it, as to give a horse a check sometimes with a bit, which doth not so much stop his course as stir his mettle. And he says later, and as it is fit to read the best authors to youth first, so let them be of the openest and clearest, as Livy before Sallust, Sidney before Donne, and beware of letting them taste Gower or Chaucer at first, lest falling too much in love with antiquity, and not apprehending the weight, they grow rough and barren in language only. When their judgments are firm and out of danger, let them read both the old and the new, but no less take heed that their new flowers and sweetness do not as much corrupt as the others' dryness and squalor, if they choose not carefully. Spenser, in affecting the ancients, writ no language, yet I would have him read for his matter, but as Virgil read Aeneas. The reading of Homer and Virgil is counseled by Quintilian as the best way of informing youth and confirming man, for besides that the mind is raised with the height and sublimity of such a verse, it takes spirit from the greatness of the matter and is tincted with the best things. Tragic and lyric poetry is good too, and comic with the best, if the manners of the reader be once in safety. In the Greek poets, as also in Plautus, we shall see the economy and disposition of poems better observed than in Terence, and the later, who thought the sole grace and virtue of their fable the sticking in of sentences, as our do the forcing in of jests. We should not protect our sloth with the patronage of difficulty. It is a false quarrel against nature that she helps understanding but in a few. When the most part of mankind inclined by her thither, if they would take the pains, no less than birds to fly, horses to run, etc., which if they lose, it is through their own sluggishness, and by that means they become her prodigies, not her children. I confess, nature in children is more patient of labor in study than in age, for the sense of the pain, the judgment of the labor is absent, they do not measure what they have done, and it is the thought and consideration that affects us more than the weariness itself. Plato was not content with the learning that Athens could give him, but sailed into Italy for Pythagoras' knowledge, and yet, not thinking himself sufficiently informed, went into Egypt to the priests and learned their mysteries. He labored, so must we. Many things may be learned together and performed in one point of time, as musicians exercise their memory, their voice, their fingers, and sometimes their head and feet at once. And so a preacher in the invention of matter, election of words, composition of gesture, look, pronunciation, motion, useth all these faculties at once. And if we can express this variety together, why should not diverse studies at diverse hours delight when the variety is able alone to refresh and repair us, as when a man is weary of writing, to read, and then again of reading, to write. Wherein, howsoever we do many things, yet are we, in a sort, still fresh to do what we begin. We are recreated with change, as the stomach is with meats. But some will say, this variety breeds confusion and makes that either we lose all or hold no more than the last. Why do we not then persuade husbandmen that they should not till land, help it with marl, lime, and compost, plant hop gardens, prune trees, look to beehives, rear sheep, and all other cattle at once? It's easier to do many things and continue than to do one thing long. And he goes on to tell about the advantages of learning and about how if you're smarter, you talk better. And many writers perplex their readers and hearers with mere nonsense. Their writings need sunshine. Pure and neat language I love, yet plain and customary. A barbarous phrase hath often made me out of love with a good sense, and doubtful writing hath racked me beyond my patience. The reason why a poet is said that he ought to have all knowledge is that he should not be ignorant of the most, especially of those he will handle. And indeed, when the attaining of them is possible, it were a sluggish and base thing to despair, for frequent imitation of anything becomes a habit quickly. If a man should prosecute as much as he could be said of everything, his work would find no end. And anyway, he was always reading. At one point, his house caught fire and burned his library. And he was in a very bad state and wrote an execration upon Vulcan, the god of fire. And then King James very kindly gave him a whole raft of money to replace a few books. Books at that time were extremely expensive and very hard to get. So much for the connection between reading and writing. Now we get on to today, which is Wednesday. Now then, I was asking you to think about the first poems and about early poetry as a social phenomenon when people were less organized than they are now, or differently organized in what we think as a tribal society or something of that kind. When we look fondly for the past, what do we find? We don't find it at all. We don't find the past. We don't find the primitive. The primary, as Olson always was after. It's hard to find because we're older than we imagine, and the universe is older than we imagine. For a long time, it was popular to imagine that the universe was created by the hand of God in the October about 12th or so of the year 4004 BC. And it was a nice day, we're told. This information comes to us from an Irish archbishop, so it must be true. His name was Usher. The descendants of that name now make a very good whiskey. But in any case, for a long time it was imagined that the Earth was not terribly old, and that people were, 7 days younger than the Earth, and had been educated by angels, and then had fallen, and then had been destroyed by flood and fire and so on, and then reconstituted afterwards. And here we all sit now, wonderfully restored and wonderfully saved by the appearance of Jesus at the proper time, who showed everybody the right way to be and live and so on. And here we are. On the other hand, there are all those other people out there. All those funny pagans and gooks and wogs and lesser breeds without the law, as Mr. Kipling said, and they're all those, they don't worship properly. They aren't Christians. So they're different. They're out there someplace else. So they're savages. You can't understand them when they talk, just like several millennia ago, the Greeks said, all those guys over there are barbarians. They go bar, 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 bar all the time. They can't talk plain. They don't talk Greek. So it is with us. We say, well, those horrible people over there are not Christians, and I can't understand them, and they're eating each other, and they don't wear clothes, and we better go civilize them. We better go save them and get them all dipped properly and made into good Christians and get them saved. And everything will be a lot better, and this will be just fine. And they can stop being primitive creatures. They can stop being savages who go about eating each other, or not wearing clothes, and not building automobiles, and not listening to the TV, and not doing all the things that nice people do. And so everybody should be like us. And anybody who isn't like us is a savage or a primitive creature, an uneducated, untutored, quasi-animal, a wild man of the woods, something like that. Now, this attitude prevailed in Western society for a good many years, and still does to a certain extent. There was a time, however, in the late 18th century when people started looking around a little bit differently, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau and some other people came out and said, huh, maybe we're not so sharp. Maybe we aren't doing it so good. Maybe what's happened is that we've all been depraved and wrecked and had our minds all twisted and whatnot, by the social arrangements which now prevail and which ought to be taken apart and thrown out, because actually people left to themselves are noble savages. People like the Indians in the Americas and the South Sea Islanders and whatnot live this simple, elegant life where they go around picking their food off of trees, and they're sweet to each other, and they dress in leaves if they dress at all. And they're natural. They're absolutely natural, just like the natural food store nowadays. You have to pay 75 cents for a lemon, and it's natural. And so this was the big pitch about how maybe human beings are groovy from the start, and then you expose them to laws and schools and social systems such as prevailed in France in the 18th century, and their heads get all funny. And they become simply turned off, sad people who presently turn to wickedness and vice and crime for amusement, instead of thinking about eating oranges and bananas off the tree. Presently they're stealing and murdering and carrying on all sorts of unattractive ways. A little later on, of course, we got into the feeling that maybe we were mistaken about the savage business. We did some investigating and found out that some of the savages had really rather complicated and marvelous ways of dealing with their own environment and with each other. And they were actually getting along quite wonderfully until they Christians came along and made them wear muus, and then they all got the tuberculosis and died. Or like in the Mariana Islands, they stopped breeding because they said, we've been wrecked by these horrible white men and we're not going to buy it, and we're going to stop, and did. The anthropologues gradually got into the idea about how maybe we were ethnocentric. We who were looking at these so-called savages were completely bent by our own training into imagining we were right and everybody else was wrong, so on, and that we thought that our way of doing things was the center of the world and how everybody was supposed to be and so on. And so we started springing our heads out in various directions and seeing maybe we were not perfect, something like that. Maybe our system wasn't the very best. And so instead of using the opprobrious terms savage or pagan or heathen or whatnot, the terms preliterate or non-literate peoples came into vogue. And I suppose that the schools of anthropology that grew up around people like Franz Boas and A.L. Kroeber and so on, are responsible for this shift. Maybe Mr. Malinowski, whatnot, came out with this business about how the idea that people were illiterate or couldn't read and write or didn't read and write wasn't so important, that wasn't the thing that made them different. But even though they didn't have a written literature, they might have had a very long oral one. They have all sorts of epics and myths and stories and songs that were not written down, but which were very carefully preserved and passed from generation to generation, so that there were many kinds of poetry. Usually the material was poetic because it was easier to memorize. Supposedly it's easier for you to remember how many days there are in each month if you remember 30 days, half September, April, June, and November. The only trouble is I can't remember that. I get into the every other one has 29 except February and so on, and it doesn't work. But for memorizing things like who your grandfather was and so forth, a rhythmical chant of genealogies was a common kind of poem that people learned in the South Seas, for example, or at least what was the lineage of their king. would be memorized, all these names. Or there would be a story about why it is goats breed in the wintertime or something like that, and it would be a metrical composition of some sort that was passed on from one goat herder to another from time immemorial. But never, maybe they never got around to writing it down, hadn't yet developed a writing system. And in addition to that kind of information, it would turn out that these so-called savages had very complicated kinds of social orders built that they were using, trips about how you treat your mother-in-law and so on, how you get through puberty. I mean, what sort of initiation rites you go through when you turn adolescent, and maybe what sort of funeral rites are celebrated when somebody dies, and all sorts of stuff, all unwritten. And so all this stuff is there somewhere that people made up as they went along. And they did it a long time ago. It's very hard to figure out how old this stuff is before any of it got written. Of course, the oldest records that we have are the ones from the Mesopotamian area, where they have those funny clay tablets, but that were baked up and saved. But those are records, belated records of much earlier material, probably. Just as the poems we think of as the Homeric epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey, were written down many centuries after they started being sung. And they, in turn, were composed or were being sung several centuries after the fact, several centuries after the alleged actions were taking place. So Homer wasn't there watching what was happening, but was telling stories that were around, that people knew about and that he knew about, and composing them into poems. So all this is much later. The writing of them, the composition of them into the regular 24 book system is a rather late manifestation. The goodness knows what the Bible must have been like before it got regularized and revamped and fixed up, because there are so many reflections in it of the earlier religion that prevailed in that area, that it must have been quite different at some time. And of course, Sir James Fraser wrote a book all about that called Folklore in the Old Testament. But in any case, a lot more work has been done on that since his time by Theodore Gaster and a lot of other people. Samuel Noah Kramer and everybody. Now then, what people did was that they sang on account they were happy or unhappy, or quite often because there was some guy there who said, all right, we're all going to sing now because George is dead. And they said, well, we sing. And the guy would say, wait a minute now. And then he'd go, the ancestors tell me that the George's spirit is standing right over there, and he says he likes to sing about the crabapple blossoms in the springtime. Everybody says, oh yeah? Isn't that right, George? Okay. Crabapple blossoms in the springtime, followed shortly thereafter by the salmon catching song, if you please. Everybody looks around and says, what's all this about? And the guy who is laying the story on them says, all right, everybody listen now. Oh, the crab apples bloom in the valley, wah, wah. Oh, the crab apples bloom in the valley, wah.
That crap apple song, that is the song that I remember.
All right, everybody line up now. In honor of George, and of course the corpse is all laid out on the ground and painted with ochre and with bones around its neck and maybe some beads and pots and all that. So everybody starts marching around. Oh, the crab apples. You've got a song and dance. And presumably they care enough about George to do this. The late George. An object of some concern to them. And it'll make them, maybe some of them, maybe like George's family and cousins are feeling kind of sad. And so it gives them something to do also, to sort of march around and sing. The reason you hop on one foot is that it goes in with the crab apples somehow, tramping out the crab apple juice, perhaps, I don't know. But anyway, some sort of rhythmical motion goes along with the beat of the song. And maybe the next day, these benighted savages are out there wondering what to do next when all of a sudden the Egypts come along. And the Egypts say, all right, you guys, come over here. They say, what? And well, come on, we're going to build this pyramid. And they say, well, what's a pyramid? And they say, well, you come on with us and you'll find out what it is. Yeah. So presently, here are the same guys now who are without George, all lined up pulling this rock. And so they're working. They're actually working and actually moving and pulling on something and singing to forget the fact that the sun is hot and they haven't had very much to eat and it's a boring job. And they are thinking about crab apples in the distance, and they're far away from that place now because the Egyptians are only giving them a little bit of weak beer and onions to eat. And no crab apples, and it's sad. And so by the waters of whatever, they're sitting there and weeping and having to pull rocks around. So you get another thing going, again, of words and music and action all happening together. Now then, the guy who has done a very great service for us all in this connection, Jerome Rothenberg, is going to be here pretty soon and read and lecture and probably make you sing and dance with him, because that's one of his big trips. He learns lots of Indian songs and tries to translate them and work up a whole bunch of other original material into some more sociable form than just a poetry reading where some guy with an English accent and a tweed suit stands up in front of a lectern and says,
This next poem solves me no end of difficulty, but I shall read it in any case, in memory of etc. Oh, night, oh, stars.
Instead, Jerry gets people to sing and dance, which is much better, much more lively proposition. People have always been singing and dancing, sort of, and to try to decide when it was or when it started or how it started and whatnot, of course, just dumb speculation. People just do it, and or not, as the case may be. Now then, a few years back, of course, there was a what various people have been pleased to call a psychedelic revolution. And many people under the influence of various kinds of curious chemical substances introduced into their physiology had various rather profound experiences. Among them, such notions that the earth is alive, and that it feels great to get your fingers in dirt or your toes or whatnot, and sort of grub around, and you can feel that it's there, and you're there, and you're really a part of it, and it's part of you. And the sun is shining, and the sun's very large, and you feel good about that. So pretty soon you're and the rocks are dancing, and the trees are dancing. So there was a slight reconstitution of the primitive that took place. And then people got very complicated about it and started talking about the earth and wanting to go off the country and grow carrots. And not only grow the carrots, but eat the carrots, because what am I putting into my body? So the health food store opens up and some guy buys a bale of carrots off of somebody and then peddles them to you as being pure. And you say, yeah, purity, right? That's what we need, purity. We got to have the farm. We got to have the pure food. That dirt is America. Scrunch, scrunch. Crunch in the toes and the fingers. America. That's what America is. Yeah, America. It is not that law. All of a sudden, we go back to being Jean-Jacques Rousseau. We're noble savages. And the next thing it strikes us is we are Indians. What do we do? We either load up our van or catch the next bus to Taos and take off all our clothes and tie a band around our hair. And if you've ever been to New Mexico and particularly to Taos, you know that the Indians are very serious people with serious problems and have the world arranged in a much different way. And the arrival of these young persons in a state of nudity to join in with their sacred festivals was a little more than they could bear. Trying to go into Taos Pueblo and do a number like that is just a little bit like going to your local neighborhood Methodist church and removing your clothing. Start saying, where's the action? You know, scooby-dooby, we're gonna join the ceremony. We're gonna hear, we're Americans. We also are Indians. We're here. And the Indians all saying, that's very nice. Please go away. Please go back to Kansas City or New York or wherever it was. We would prefer, you're making a disturbance. Please, quiet. So we have our beads, we have feathers and beads and eagle feet in the ears, and it's wonderful. Now, of course, it gave us a marvelous insight into such things as shamanism and yoga and whatnot, and everybody, I hope, is familiar with those works by Mircea Eliade, the Romanian transplanted Chicago scholar. Who has a pretty complete rundown on those subjects and books available now in paperback. All this was very strange to me, this Indian trip. I grew up in Oregon in a small town called The Dalles, which is right on the Columbia River, just east of the Cascade Mountains. And 10 miles east of The Dalles at that time, there was an Indian reservation at Salalo Falls. All that, of course, has been wiped out by the construction of a giant dam at Big Eddy, just above the Dalles. And so the Salalo Falls are drowned now, where the Indians used to fish and for salmon, and where they lived in little shacks that they made out of tin and cardboard. There were, on the other side of the railway tracks, the UP goes right by there, on the other side of the railroad tracks were these horrible little tourist bungalows, which had been built by the U.S. Indian Service for the Indians to live in, and the Indians declined. And, I mean, after all, who wants to live in a small wooden shack that's about as long as from here to the door and about as wide as from the wall to about here, when you can live down by the river where it's nice and where the willows are and be comfortable and where the dirt is. And there were those guys doing that. And I saw, of course, cowboy movies in which there were noble Indians doing wonderful things. And in the school books, there were the school books in Oregon at that time were all printed in New England, incidentally. So there were noble red men in the school books, creatures of the Hiawatha type, and then later when we were in high school, the last of the Mohicans. So here were these different layers of Indian in my head. One of my relatives collected a bunch of pots from when she was on a trip into New Mexico and Arizona years ago. She had them around her house, and I thought they were rather nice. And then in the museum at the Dalles, there was a lot of strange stuff, arrowheads and mortars, stone mortars, and a few beady things. But nothing like all the stuff that was in the school books about how Indians were people who did things with dyed porcupine quills, for example. Just like the poetry in the school books was about the first hepatica of the springtime. Well, my God, in the Dalles, I don't think there's anything like a hepatica ever thought of growing, much less a fringe gentian, being that it's right on the edge of a high desert country. So in the springtime up there, it all looks different. And also, we don't have 35 feet of snow every winter like they do in New England. It was a very strange feeling of this double world. I mean, one world with real Indians who were people who stood around and who spoke as if they had a mouthful of mashed potatoes. They spoke some brand of Chinook Indian. Very interesting sounds. And who were very quiet people. They just stood. And the gentleman had long braids on each side of the ears and a hat, a Stetson hat with a flat brim and then the crown that went right straight up like that. And they wore buckskin shoes and a bright colored shirt. And the ladies did their heads up in a bright head rag and had long dresses and buckskin booties and they'd wear a Pendleton blanket around their shoulders and carry the kids in a cradle, but in a cradle board with a flat board where the kids were strapped in with blanketing, and then there was a little frame that stuck out over their face like this with beads hanging down, in the hope of actually of making the child cross-eyed, which is a mark of beauty. In any case, very much like Polish infants of several centuries ago, the children were bound up, swaddled in these boards. And they were mysterious beings. They were mainly because they were quiet and because you couldn't understand them. And also because my parents told me that they were dirty and they were bad. And they stole dogs and did all sorts of dreadful things. And not to associate with them, not to talk to them, to sort of stay away. They were just there. Buying things at the dry goods store or standing in front of the bank, large monumental people, very quiet. And then in the book, of course, they were somebody else. Later on, I got into accounts in other books about how there were such things as Indian languages that had funny stories in them. And that the Indians originally came from Asia, a place that I was interested in, and that there were other Indians, especially in the Southwest and further south, in Mexico and South America, who had created all sorts of interesting architecture and painting and so on. And that was strange and peculiar. Much, much later, I was able to visit a kiva, some kivas in the Three Holies Canyon, what do you call it, Bandler National Monument, and found them quite magical places to be. Underground cave-type, artificial caves. Very much probably like the natural caves in Europe where people were drawing paintings and whatnot a long time ago, and making up ceremonies, making up poems and dances and whatnot to get them through various kinds of crises. Now then, another thing we find out, whether through meditation, through the practice of yoga, or whatever, maybe just by reading the Buddhist Abhidharma literature, you find out that that our distinction, and the distinction that our language and thought makes between inside and outside, is false. What world we have is thought. What world we see is our thinking. And so actually, there isn't any outside and inside, just like there isn't any primitive or savage. The more we look at the world, the more we see that it's alive and that it is organized and that it's behaving in some interesting fashion. We see design and intelligence in operating in flowers, like in those stop motion pictures that Walt Disney started taking of flowers growing and whirling around and around in the air, going places. Very much more alive than we ever thought of flowers ever being. We used to think that flowers just stood there and they sprouted up and then they stood there until they keeled over and that was the end of it. But actually, of course, they go through all this motion, they're dancing. Trees do the same thing. We watch the behavior of various chemicals, or we watch crystals happening. We found out about viruses, how these funny things that are crossed between a live germ and a dead chemical sprouting out, walking around. Or we find out about the ribonucleic acid and so on, all about the RNA-DNA twist going on inside of everything with all its information and so on. Or we find out more recently about the phenomenon of streaming in plant cells, about how inside each cell all sorts of complicated social arrangements are going on. Even after you've cut the thing out and are looking at it under the microscope, they live for quite a while. There are these reports, of course, that you've read of the carrot screaming as you pull it out of the ground, or the cucumber wincing when you bite it, or the plant trembling if you cuss at it for not growing properly, or responding benignly to the strains of Beethoven, but quivering with rage when it hears something else. Making meat eaters of us all. We don't dare eat any vegetables anymore because they're all gone. So we go back to eating each other. We can't mess with those plants. We can't mess with the universe so carelessly anymore, perhaps, because everything is connected. We are connected to it, and we're messing with ourselves, actually, when we tamper with something else. My teacher, Dick Baker, said that one day he was on his way back to his warehouse when he was working down there. He was coming back from lunch and he was eating a bar of candy and he threw the wrapper away. And he said it suddenly got to him that he had thrown the wrapper in his own face and he had to pick it up and put it in his pocket and think up what to do with it. because he was out of doors, he was outside. He said if he had been in the warehouse, he wouldn't have thrown it on the floor because somebody would have had to pick it up or sweep it up or whatever, and or put it in a garbage can, whatnot. But here he was outside, and we ordinarily think, you know, if you're outdoors, you just spit on the ground or pee on it or whatever and throw it without thinking about it. But who is that? Where does it go? Of course, what it does, it lodges right in this part of your ear right here, something like that, when you throw things. And so you have to be careful about where it is you are, the fact that there isn't any outside the house or inside. That's a very funny idea. In Japan, in China, they had not that distinction either, that the hinaus and outside the house, are different things in our language, but in Japan especially, they have no real idea about inside and outside. Except that the inside is pretty magical, and if the cat comes in, it's pretty scary. Now then, one of the various ways we find out anyway that the inside is really outside and the outside is really inside, like Gertrude Stein said one time. And then we say, I want out. And so we get high on something. On dancing and singing is one way, chanting, fasting, doing yoga, doing meditation, we get a feeling of release that we say is out, but actually what we're doing is going the way, we're going in. Or Ginsberg used to say, in my skin, or in the body at last, or in the same boat of meat, things, that feeling of understanding, of being in, of being here, of being meat walking around and connected with everything else. And this is kind of an experiential theology. This feeling of existing as a creature and so on, I think, is what the Catholic theologians were after when they started tripping out about the mystery of the incarnation. I mean, literally, incarnation, to be in meat, to be a person who is at the same time this physical manifestation is a thing that you have to know by doing it or by realizing it. It's not just a theory. Gary Snyder, in a poem called Milton by Firelight, tells about working on a trail crew all day and then sitting at night after dinner reading Milton by the light of an open fire, and he says toward the end of it, he's high on mountains in poetry. And that's one of the things that can happen if you are really into poetry, is that it will spring your head around funny ways if you sit and read it and really pick up on what you're reading. It will snap you out of where it was you thought you were, or what it was you were worrying about. So like George's relatives, you feel better. I had a funny experience a couple of days ago. I was sitting in the airplane at the San Francisco airport. The airport is 15 miles south of downtown San Francisco. And it sits out on a chunk of fill out in the edge of the bay, so that you take off and land over the water. And I was sitting there and reading Don Juan, Byron's Don Juan, which I'd never read before, and looking out the window once in a while. I looked out at one point and realized that I wasn't anywhere at all. That it was just down. It was just the ground. It was I was looking at this concrete outside of the airplane. The airplane at that moment was still connected up to the to its loading platform. But I could have been anywhere. you know how airports look alike, or how airplanes are all alike, and then the airports try to look alike, so you never know whether you're in Denver or Salt Lake or Chicago or where you are, except that you're down and that you're all right. You're in the airplane, and you're just totally disconnected from everything. It's very funny, very nice feeling. And then, so in that case, where is home? I didn't think of myself as being at home in San Francisco, and I wasn't in Boulder, and I wasn't any place. I was just there. And then it occurred to me that where I was at was in words, and because by this time I was trying to write about this in my notebook. And so that the real home was partly Byron, partly the poetry I had been reading, and the rest of it was what I was writing, was where I really am at, really where I was living. And it was comfortable to be in the airplane and to be. It didn't matter whether I was in San Francisco or Tashkent or wherever, I was just there. Being alone with the language, like Gertrude Stein used to say. She lived in Paris, as you know, most a great deal of her life, and she said it felt very nice to do business in French all day and talk to a lot of people in French when she spoke. But because this let her be alone with English when she was by herself and was trying to write The Making of Americans or whatever, she had a feeling of being right with it. I thought that was, again, what she called later on a literary formalism. I thought that was just an idea. But I actually had the experience later on when I was living in Kyoto of operating in Japanese a lot of the day, and then I would sit down and I'd start thinking in English and or hearing myself in English or whatnot. It's a very interesting experience. You are left all alone with that marvelous language, and you write it down or not. So there are no savages anymore, except in the Pentagon, maybe, or something like that. And there's no age to the universe. Everything is here right now. And everything fits together in funny ways. We become more conscious of the connections between things the longer we live and the longer we sit to meditate or think about where we're at. Ms. Stein says that poetry is actually names. It's actually calling on the name of something. That's one of her definitions of what poem is. It's something that calls on the name of something. And so maybe among the people that I was talking about a while ago who were having a funeral, maybe the first part of the ceremony was that everybody went very slowly around saying, George, 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 come back, George, come back, George, George. Here's poor George all laid out stiff and cold. George, please come back, George, 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 and so on. And so maybe then the crab apples came next or something like that. But anyway, this calling of a name is a very interesting idea. Now, we learn in reading about American Indians that one of the things that a lot of people did was when they were adolescent was to go way out in the wilderness and call for help, literally. They were told that if they went out there and fasted and in some lonely place, far away from other people, if you fasted and kept calling for a helper, that after a while you would receive help. You would have a vision or something would happen. Some event would take place, which was your personal helper coming to help you and who would give you a name. And maybe teach you a song and a dance, if you had any luck at all. And maybe the first time, though, you would at least get a name if you didn't get anything else. And so you had to stay there and cry, and to call, help, I suppose. Where is the help at? Help. Calling, anyway. The thing of really demanding, really putting out a scream, because you're all alone. You're all alone, and it's scary out there. There's nobody around. Tibetans feel that if you're out someplace where there aren't very many people, then there's lots of ghosts. Lots of ghosts and spirits and demons are likely to be around. Whereas if you're in a place like this where many people are around you, the chances of being possessed by some evil spirit are very small. Japanese feel much the same way. And apparently the American Indians in some places had something of that feeling, that being alone was dangerous and frightening, and but that it could be rewarding, that it could, you could get something out of it. And in this particular case, the thing about names was very important. Now, with lots of people, if you can find out what their name is and call them by it, they have to give up at that point and submit to either having you kill them or doing whatever it is you say you want them to do, because names are secret.